You know what? I'm going to open up this podcast by saying I got a 13 on my ACT, a 13, and I'm pretty sure you can't even get into some prisons with a score like that. Joining me on the podcast today is Brian Latimer, and appreciate you being here, man, and taking some time out of your day. It's been a while since I've had an interaction with a human being, so appreciate you being here, dude.
You and me both. It is the summer now, so I don't really have any students to torture. So, I kind of get that. And I'm broadcasting live from the middle of nowhere, Virginia. I am surrounded by Mennonites and Moo Cows out here. So they don't like to talk to me because I'm a little bit of a long-haired hippie in their eyes.
What's that guy doing? He's got a wig on. Come on.
There's no man ever wears anything like that.
How they talk?
No, for the most part, the Mennonites around here are pretty cool. They interact with us. It is a little funny when their men talk to my wife, because like they don't really engage with women outside of their community too often. So it's kind of a little interesting. She's had some interesting conversations with them.
That's probably another podcast we can do alone on that.
I grew up in Amish country back home people. So yeah. In my opinion, Mennonites are kind of like the weekend warrior version, like, cause they're not as hardcore, as Amish are. But it just depends on the sect of them, because they all have different rules. Like most of them still allow batteries to be used. There just can't be any dependency on.
It seems like cheating a little bit.
Well, because you're not relying on an external source. There's some wonky loopholes that they use. It's out there, and I do my best to understand.
Well, that's good. Yeah, well, I'd assume you do because you're a teacher. So knowledge is power, right?
Yeah, I say that I teach people. now, whether or not they learn anything is another story, but...
Well, there's that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into it then. Shit, man. Everyone's like, what are we going to talk about today? Well, I started the podcast off by saying I got a 13 on my ACT, so where do you think this is going? Let's do some background. Let's set a foundation. So can you take us, like, what is your current stance on academia today? Like,
okay.
Yeah. Just what is your standpoint here?
So currently in academia, we are facing, this oncoming obstacle or panic. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's called the Cliff of 2028 or 2026. I can't remember the exact date. Okay, so everybody in the bigger schools, your R1s, so basically the places that have prominent football programs and that, they are concerned because we are about to go into a college eligible population dip. If you remember in 2008, we had that housing crisis and whatnot. And so everyone, I guess, you know, to save money, they quit, you know, popping out babies. So, there was a decline in the birth rate since then. And so now everyone's worried that they're not going to make their numbers, moving forward.
And it's strictly just like a money thing when it out of their eyes.
That's part of it. A lot of what you see in academia nowadays is money driven. I don't know where you went. I don't know what your experience was, but a lot of schools nowadays deal with basically everything's more on the experience and not the education itself.
Right. Right.
And that is why you see a lot of places that offer a lot of things that, you know, just seem wild to me that exist. Like certain, some schools have lazy rivers. Some
like an actual lazy, like,
oh yeah,
there's nothing behind that. It's like an actual lazy river.
Yeah, it's an actual lazy river. I believe it's LSU.
Sure,
LSU has a lazy river that you can, you know, that's part of your student dues, which to me is hilarious. It's like, okay, didn't you come here to learn a thing? I call me nuts. I mean, I don't know who's fitting your bill, but is the lazy river necessary?
Yeah, I'm going to say that's pretty awesome, but no.
Yeah.
I was not, no. There's a movie, I forgot, it's called like College maybe or something, where these kids make their own college.
I know that movie that is Accepted from 2006. Accepted,
yeah,
from 2006, starring Lewis Black.
That's right.
My personal hero.
Amazing.
South Harmon Institute of Technology.
Yeah, dude, nice. Hell yeah. So when you're saying a lazy river like that, that's just shot into my mind. I'm like, that's like Accepted for sure.
Yeah, that's the bigger thing now. It's, and you know, schools are competing basically for the experience. It's not the idea of hey, I'm going to this place to get this this education from these professors. Not that that's ever really been a thing. I'm sorry, if you go to undergrad looking to be under the tutelage of some professor, you probably need help. But you know, that was a thing, and it's not like it's still not a thing. It still happens, but by and large, most students make the decision to go to their respective undergrad, usually out of a couple of different rationales. One, athletic scholarship. That's usually a big one. Two, is convenience, like location. Some places that students go is just basically out of location. I went and got my master's degree at a place that I was like, oh, this place has a great skate scene. This is where I'm going to go. I didn't even really care about the program. It's just, oh, I'm going to be in Atlanta. That's awesome. You know, so I'm not immune to it either.
What year was that when you were looking?
Oh, that was 2008. That was 2008.
Sweet. Okay, we're around the same age. I graduated high school 2006.
Okay, you're about 10 years younger than me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I graduated high school in 97.
Oh, sweet. Okay. Yeah.
So to my students, I'm an old fart that's kind of hipping with it, but you know, I'm not hipping with it because I still use words like hip.
You sound young. You still got that youthful voice, which is good.
Well, thanks. I'm glad someone thinks that.
Not a compliment. I'm just kidding.
Nah, it's all right.
I'm just kidding, dude.
Oh, please. My wife calls me an old fogey all the time. The old fart. There's... No one uses that stuff anymore. I'm like, I'm sorry. Yeah. It's what I know.
All right, babe. There's got to be social media influence as well nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think that's a premier tool to use to capture the youth and like where to go? Like there's a lot of these phrases going around like brain rot. You ever heard of that?
Yes. Oh, I'm very familiar with brain rot. We in the faculty, I don't care what institution I've been to, talk about, they don't necessarily call it brain rot, but they do have those concerns. And the thing that I've always thought about brain rot is I find it funny because it's a generational thing. It's not like it's exclusive to the Utes today. It's actually something that has carried on forever.
Totally.
My generation was told we are rotting our brains because we couldn't keep our hands off our Super Nintendos. And like, we're just gonna, you know, you're not gonna amount to anything because all you're doing is sitting there and playing the video games. And it's like, it's what I know and it's what I play, you know. And previous generations said the same thing about kids who sat and watched television or listened to radio. Hell, it's even been the same thing when kids were reading books in the 19th century. So it's not like it's a brand new phenomenon. It's one of those things where it's just a new method. And the only reason why people get grumpy about it is because it's not their generation. And they forgot what it's like to be 15 and bored. So I've always kind of understood it, but you know, people have their perspective about it all the time. I'm always willing to debate with them, but usually they don't want to hear that stuff.
Yeah, no, I agree with you that it's totally a generational thing. Yeah, as you just did, you went down the line and like just gave some facts about what it was in previous generations. Like when the printing press came out for that reading, what you were saying, yeah, people thought that people were going to lose their damn minds. You know, the only people that used to read, I think it was priests, like way back.
Yes. Back then, it was primarily the only people who were literate were nobility and priests.
Yeah.
The vulgar, the common person was not. They might be able to read in their language, sure, but there was very little that was actually handwritten for them. And then when the Gutenberg press shows up, the first thing that happens is the Gutenberg Bible, which is written in vulgar German, and the peasantry can read it, and then all of a sudden ideas pop up. Like, hey, all this stuff you've been telling us, it doesn't match up with what's in here.
See, yeah, that's a sketchy thing, because the priests were able to, like, they can read and then take their bias and then spit it out into, you know, using
right,
their language. And
yes.
Yeah, that's a real problem. I do you feel like we're living through some of that today through social media platforms, where they're kind of, you know, freezing what can be said on social networks, like what you see, you're not getting the whole story.
Well, social networks, you can be pretty out there. You just got to be able to find your niche. And it's another thing. And I mean, you can experience the same thing just even doing a podcast, you know, whatever it is that your voice is, finding that audience, because there will be an audience for anything. I mean, if people still believe that the earth is flat and there's whole communities for that, I'm pretty sure, you know, you can find your niche to get your thing out there. Now that's one of the great things about social media, is you can by and large get what you want out. Now, whether or not people are going to be drawn to it is another story, but you can. Now I do know that, you know, people who have a lot more influence, you know, bigger audiences and whatnot, yeah, they get a little bit more carte blanche and power. And I see how that's playing out with people who are, you know, have contracts with Twitch or YouTube or right, whoever. Right. And it's like, okay, but I still feel that people have you have these platforms. Whether or not people are listening to you is another story. It's kind of like the people who, you know, stand on the corner with the tinfoil on their head screaming something, and, you know, maybe they get one or two people to listen to them, but by and large, people are just walking by.
Right. Yeah. So you brought up Twitch, and I'll just run with this for a second. Twitch, I think Ninja used to be on there, and he was like, he had a mega following, right?
Yeah.
So when it comes to people like that, these social media stars, the youth sees that. I have a kid, he's 7 years old now, so the youth sees that, and I'm seeing it firsthand, and they're drawn to that so much that it's, do you think that school is going to be on the back burner, like people don't want to get educated anymore or don't care to go further their education, they would rather try and pursue to be a celebrity or try to pursue being famous, whatever that means. I don't even know what it means. People just want to be famous to be famous. It's crazy. So I don't know if education is going to take a back seat to that.
Well, okay. So there's a couple of things you can unpack with this. One, kids are going to be kids. I remember when I was in school, would sit in class bored out of my skull, and all I'm thinking about is like going home and playing The Legend of Zelda. Like, I don't really care about hypotenuse. I'm trying to beat the eighth dungeon right now. Like,
that's right.
I don't care about this, right?
That beautiful bitch.
Yeah. So it's like, I'm, you know, my mind's that, you know, in that direction. And so I don't think it can't. I mean, you can still see kids get too drawn in to it. You know, they don't have a little bit of guidance saying, hey, you know, these people that, you know, have these mass followings, they are the exception, not the rule. And you need to understand that, you know, they got to where they are through some level of hard work. You know, they had to learn certain skills, whether it was how to do some video editing or, you know, audio mixing or whatever on top. Yeah. Well, I'm not saying everybody has the innate talents. I mean,
that was crazy, dude.
I mean, look, if we can have people who can just be an NPC for 3 hours and make $7,000, sure. But again, they are the exception, not the rule. And in ways they are genius because they found a way to grift the system, and congratulations to them. I'm not angry at them. I'm kind of admiring of them because they figured something out.
Sure.
As nonsensical as that could be. So, if they go into that understanding, because that's one of the things that I've tried to get through students' heads. So I teach mass communication classes, and in the past, at my last institution, we had television broadcasting and whatnot. And you know, you get some students who think, "Oh, I'm going to be the star, and I'm going to be, you know, in front of the camera doing all this." I'm like, you know, Oprah Winfrey, she knew all the stuff that was going on in the back behind the camera before she ever stepped foot in front of the camera. So, you know, you need to take in consideration that, you know, one of the most powerful people out there knew what the floor director was doing, knew what the technical director had to do, and knew the, you know, why it's important to have a script. You know, you just can't waltz up here and like, I'm going to be fabulous. It's like, right. No, it's not how right. This stuff works. Yeah. So it really depends on, like I said, getting to understand there's a lot of work involved. And just to dovetail on that with the competing with education, there are ways in which education, and in my own cynical brain, this is where it's going to be going. Like, I'm not going to be surprised within the next 3 years, some institution somewhere is going to offer you like a degree in being something like a YouTuber or an influencer.
I
don't doubt it. I could literally see that, because a lot of students will approach me asking me how to do things, and I'll be like, cool, yeah, you want to learn, you know, come see me this time and I'll sit you down and we'll talk all the technical specs and all this stuff, and I'll give you some individualized training. I don't have to do that stuff, but I like to do it, because if students have the general curiosity, I want them to, you know, learn from somebody who has done such things. Like, I had a student, this was like a year ago, approach me. He wanted to start doing, you know, video game live streaming. Cool. I'm all aboard for that. So, you know, I took him through the whole thing. You know, this is the kind of stuff I would recommend. This is this software here is free. You know, you just need this one, you know, basically the cheapest way you could set up the thing up. And I'm like, one thing that's going to be really important is you got to have a little bit of charisma in front of the camera. Yep. So I know sometimes it can be very hard when you're, you know, you're deeply focused on surviving an Elden Ring or whatever, but you gotta somewhat interact with your audience. And I'm like, just, you know, try it over the weekend or something. And he came back and was like, I can't do this. And I'm like,
really?
Well. Yeah. He's like, see, you learned, and you didn't really have to spend that much money to experience this. Like, I kind of bummed out that he quit after like one try or whatever, but he did it. And, you know, he's like, okay, maybe this isn't for me, because some people don't have that awareness that maybe this isn't for them, in whatever it is. Kind of like when you watch a movie and there's just some actors that's like, you're a nepotism hire. You shouldn't be in front of the camera for anything. So
yeah, there seems to be a lot of that going on.
Yeah. So
that's a very good point about, but see, I'm caught up because if he only tried it for like a minimal amount of time,
mm-hmm.
I mean, do you really know what you're capable of? Maybe it just takes some time to get past that stage of uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know,
that is a hard thing for, I do wonder about that sometimes with youth nowadays. My age bracket, I don't like the third generation stuff out there, but you know, they like my generation is like Gen Xers or whatever the hell I am. I don't even know. I'm just like, I'm a dude and the dude abides, but
yeah, in Virginia.
Yeah. It's just whatever. You know, they're like, well, you know, when I was growing up, it's like I had dirt and rocks to play with and I was perfectly fine. I didn't need a tablet or whatever. And it's like, these kids are soft, but it's like,
that's like, look at you now. You're a mess.
Yeah. It's like, well, judging by how you look right now and the only thing you're lifting on the weekends are 12 ounce curls, I don't really think you should be making these judgment calls.
Yeah,
but I do wonder, you know, about resiliency. Like in my classroom, yeah, I'm going to see some resilient students. Sometimes they think I'm the devil and that's perfectly acceptable. And so they, you know, they're like, you're really hard, but I'm learning something from you. And I'm like, that's all I really want. I mean, I've been called all sorts of things under the sun and I'm totally cool with it. I've told my students, you can tell your friends whatever you want about me. You can badmouth me all you want. I just know that what I'm offering you are the best practices for what I'm here to do. And I'm willing to negotiate with you if we do have a problem. You know, I'm not one of those people in front of the classroom who, you know, like I rule with an iron fist. You know, everything that comes out of my mouth is gospel truth. And you mm-hmm. should be writing down every little thing. Like I one of the things that I've never understood, is when my fellow faculty get all offended when their students are, you know, paying attention to their smart brick than them. Cause it's like, my argument for that has always been, have you thought maybe it's you?
Can't be me.
I mean, that's the thing, you know, you spend minimum 10 years going through this academic hazing to, you know, earn this title of doctor. And, you know, some people that goes to their head and like everything that they've ever thought is so stinking important. And that you little peon who are, you are graced to be in my presence right now.
Oof, geez. Is there a lot of that in the academia world?
Sadly, yes. And I view it like this. So like I've said, we usually go through 10 years of, for the most part, 10 years of college to get to this point, right? And here's the thing that most people don't understand when it comes to getting your PhD. So you go through your master's program and your PhD, and your PhD is basically the elongated version of your master's. And in your PhD program, generally what happens is you go through 2 years of seminars. So it's not five classes, it's three. But these classes meet one day a week for like 3 hours. Usually, at least in my field, you're told, here's a book, read it. We're going to talk about it next week. And then everyone acts like they read it, but no one actually did. So we try to BS our way through it the next week. Everybody knows this is just a weird circle jerk, but whatever. And you are expected.
Now you're talking my language.
it's bizarre. We just blow so much smoke. I mean, it's like you expect Snoop Dogg to be there. but at the end of the semester, you're expected to write a seminar paper related to the subject matter of the course. Usually it's 20 to 25 pages, completely cited and all this junk. So it's like you got an entire semester to do this research, and it's, you know, usually three classes. So on average, I was writing between 75 to 90 pages a semester of research on maybe various topics. You do that for 2 years, and then you go through your third year, which is your comprehensives. And comprehensives is where you're dissertation committee, which usually is composed of five people, four of those people are going to ask you questions. And they usually give you four questions and you pick one from each of them. And you have 3 hours to answer each question. And you write everything that you know about that topic without any help, any notes, any nothing. It's just you. And I remember my responses were roughly 20 pages a response. That was over 2 days. Like I would answer one question in the morning and then one question in the afternoon. And then do that again the next day. And I remember the room that I did it in had no windows. It was just a pale white room. It basically, yeah, it was like an isolation. And it was just like, here you go. Like, oh, goody. I'm here with my thoughts. That's where I want to be right now.
When you're writing these lengthy papers, are you keeping in mind what the professors want to hear? Are you going all you? Like you don't give a fuck what they're about to read. This is you.
Well, here's another dirty little secret. They don't really read the stuff.
No.
They'll say they do, but I highly doubt it. Well, they might skim it and look for the stuff that they want. So sometimes you look to placate them. Sometimes if you're feeling really ballsy, you don't.
Yeah.
It just depends on your relationship with that person, because you pick your committee, and sometimes you don't really have much of a choice, because whatever your committee is usually people who are comprised of, they know very specific things about the stuff you're researching. So like maybe they're an expert in one thing and, you know, they're going to have their say and they're going to have these, well, I insist that you include this dead philosopher from 1850, and I swear to the good Lord above, if you don't have it, you are not walking out of this institution with a PhD.
God, and it's like, eat some mushrooms, chill out.
Well, I mean, but that's this is the kind of insanity you're gonna get. But as long as you sort of placate them, like, yeah, I understand this is important, they're gonna be cool with it, and you gotta have. Out of those four questions, three of those people have to say, I'm cool with these answers. So you gotta, you know, gotta pass with a 75. And it's either satisfactory or unsat. That's all you get.
Oh, Jesus, man.
And then comes the fun part.
Oh, that wasn't the fun part?
No.
Oh.
No. The next part is your dissertation. Your dissertation is basically your life's work. Up to that point, you pick a topic, whatever random topic it's going to be, and you then work on it. In fact, you don't have any classes anymore. It is just, this is your life. The only thing you do, depending on the school that you go to, you might teach your classes, because usually what PhD students do is they go to a school and the school says, all right, you won't have to pay any money to be here except maybe mandatory fees, but you got to do us a favor. You got to teach some lower level courses. And in return, you know, we'll waive tuition and we'll give you a little bit of a stipend for teaching these mongrels.
And a free pass to the lazy river.
Yeah. Yeah. If your place had it. No, I was all Twitter that, we had a rock climbing wall. I was like, ooh, that's neat.
So
I don't really want to climb rocks, but I guess it's cool.
Oh, man.
So you work on this thing. I worked on mine. See, I was a little bit smart about mine. I had my project sort of figured out before I got to my program. So
oh, that's
I was
nice.
Kind yeah. Cause if you don't go in knowing what you really want to do, it's gonna be worse. But When you start going through it, basically the next 18 months of your life is dedicated to this thing. And my dissertation was 350 pages.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Stop.
Oh, mine was short.
That's a long book.
And so, you know, you work on it, your dissertation chair will, you know, say, hey, let's have a meeting. Let's see how you're doing. And you'll, you know, you routinely send stuff out, you know, and they'll send you back notes. maybe, because these people are really busy and they don't have time to read everything. They'll read what they care about. They don't care about everything. So they'll read about what they care about, and you get notes back and forth. And then when you your dissertation chair agrees that you're ready for defense, you go in for defense. And in defense, it is a 2-hour meeting where your committee basically says, this dissertation sucks, change our minds. And you have to, you know, handle whatever questions they throw at you during this process. And you got to defend it to the best of your ability. And there will be some, thankfully mine wasn't this bad, but there are some who, like, no, you didn't include this guy who I really like. And because you didn't include it, you are completely wrong. And no matter what you use as a defense on that and rationale, like, well, okay, that would be great, but I'm not really talking about this particular thing, so it doesn't really apply here. Yeah. They don't want to hear it.
They just corner you.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes other committee members will come in to, like, try to save you, but they all can be weird. So you go through that for 2 hours. Then they kick you out of the room. And then they talk for like 15 minutes. And
do you think they have their answer pretty quick and then just make you sweat out the other, you know, 13 minutes?
Oh, yeah. Mine, I can easily say mine was pretty open and shut. The only thing that they did, now this is back when Skype was still really big, and so distance stuff was sort of still new. One of my committee members left the institution and went international to Canada. And so he was Skyping in from Canada, and he was about to buy a house. Well, if you know anything about Canadian housing market, even a nice simple home is like $500,000. And so he was closing on his house the same day.
Oh no.
And he's like, yeah, I'm. He even admitted that before we started. And I know for the entire time they kicked me out, so that they could, you know, argue whether or not it was good enough. They were talking about, you know, what's the difference between closing a house in the United States versus closing a house in Canada. And so when they brought me back in, they're like, congratulations, Dr. Latimer. And it's like, yay.
Oh, is that what they said? That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, because it's the first time you can be officially called doctor.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet.
Yeah, and see, this is where the hang-up comes up, right? So you go through all of this, okay? And for some people, grad school is, it can be a pretty chill ride. I thought mine, yeah, I had my ups and downs. Yeah, it drove me nuts on occasion, but I didn't think I had a bad time. But for a lot of people, it's this weird version of academic hazing that we go through, you know, and you know, you're like, I spent 10 years to, you know, suffer for my love of knowledge and whatnot. And so when they come out, they demand you call them Dr. So-and-so.
I was going to ask that, like, the ego just immediately hits you.
Yes. And so if you ever run into a professor who insists that you call them Dr. So-and-so,
yeah,
they had a bad time. That's basically what that boils down to.
Okay, I had a professor time at my college, and tell me what you think about this. Wrote him an email.
Oh, God.
We were on pretty decent terms. I mean, I started my email off by, hey, Dr. Phil. You know, whatever. I'm not going to say his real name. It was, hey, Dr. Phil. And then,
well, he ain't a real doctor either.
Comma. That's what I've heard. Comma. And then I continued down with what I had to ask him. This guy blew me out of the water for starting off with, hey, Dr. Blah. He thought it was the most disrespectful thing. And, you know, I guess I can see that, but that wasn't my intentions at all. I've never heard from anybody else when I started an email off like that, that was ever an issue, but this guy just lit me up and I'll never forget it.
So I personally do not have much of a problem. I've told my students, you know, you can call me whatever you want. You can call me Dr. Latimer, Mr. Latimer. Just don't call me by my first name.
Yeah.
We're not cool like that.
Right.
I'm not your bra. So,
hey, bro.
I'm a little bit more loose with it. Now I do have a class where the institution that put me in charge of this professional communication course, it's basically to help our business students. And one of the things that I have to talk about in there is like, how do you properly communicate, especially emails to people? Right. And I'm like, look, I get it. You are accustomed to, you know, talking to people in a certain way, but there are instances where you got to be as formal as possible. And this is an appropriate time. These are the appropriate times when to use them. And you know, by and large, with the emails that I get, I'm totally cool. I have received, and I actually keep them. I post them on my wall because I find them funny. Emails where things have gone awry. This is years ago.
It's your wall of shame.
I don't call it a wall of shame. I just call it like, I don't even really have a name for it. It's just like this. Please don't ever do these things. So like I had a student, I was teaching a, communication law class. Basically what you do is you talk about the First Amendment. Cool. And in that class, I have you write, I made it sound like it was worse than it actually was. You had to write 4 case study papers in which you had to talk. I give you a Supreme Court case, and you have to, examine the facts of the case. What was the court's decision? What did this now mean for the First Amendment? Right. And I made it to them. It sounded hellacious. Like, oh, my God, you are inhumane. It's a 3-page paper minimum. Like, and it really shouldn't be that hard. And it's due once a month. They all knew at the end of the month, this paper was due. I had this student who emailed me very angrily after finals about how he was dissatisfied with his grade. You get that all the time. Some students think they do way better than what they actually do. It happens. So I get this email and he's like, Dr. Latimer, I am appalled at my grade. Oh, interesting. Okay. What is your rationale for this? I am appalled because I did 3 of the 4 papers that you had us do this semester. Okay. So let's do some really quick, easy math here. The entire class is graded on 4 papers. So even if you did the first 3 perfectly and you didn't do the last one, you're still 3/4, 75% is the best you're going to get, right? Well, I hate to break it to your heart, Buttercup, but you didn't do the 3 papers that you did do perfectly. They were a little substandard. Well, we're not going to split hairs there, but okay.
You're breaking hearts.
Yeah, I'm just so awful. Standards and grammar, holy cow. Can't believe, like, these are deal breakers in this day and age. So he's like, I did all this work for you, and I didn't receive the grade that I deserved. And here's where it got me, and this is why it's pinned on my wall. I don't know if he just typed this out in anger or what, but the next sentence was, you and complete asshole. And I'm like, all right.
He has like cutouts from magazines with the other letters on it.
Yeah, it's kind of what it felt like. But I'm like, and he rattled off a couple more things. But I was like, you know what? This is going on my wall. This is beautiful. Another one I had not too long ago. He was upset at my door policy. I kind of gave up this door policy, but at first I thought it was a good idea. When class starts, I lock the door. Because I'm like, well, I kind of getting you in training for, an actual work day. Because my mother, she worked in a factory, and if she didn't clock in on time, she would get deducted points. And the point system at her place is weird. I don't really understand it. But, like, it could lead to deduction of pay, possible even termination, right? And I'm like, if it's good enough for a factory worker, it should be good enough for you. So like, if you're not here on time, I lock the door and you're absent for the day. I don't care how much you beat on the door, and some students do. I just keep on going. It's your own damn fault. So he emailed me right outside the door. Bruh. Your door policy. Your door policy is terrible. And I'm like, all right. And so basically my response to him was this very eloquent, dear student so-and-so. I want this to be a teaching moment right now, but when you are not satisfied with the service that you are provided at our fair institution, if you wish to display your disgust, may I suggest first that you take 5 minutes to cool down so that the next things that come out of your mouth in an email or any correspondence with me is something that you will not regret. Second, when you do air your disgust with a faculty member here, you might want to do it in the most proper of ways. And then I show an example. I'm like, you can be very creative with it. You can tell me that I'm a complete jerk, but if you do it in an eloquent way, I'll at least laugh at it. Opening with bruh doesn't really apply to this. And so I'm like, do we understand each other? And the response was, yeah, dude, got it.
Like, wow. He probably went out and choked the janitor after that one. He was probably fuming.
I was like, what? So sometimes it feels like I'm wasting my breath, but it's like, whatever.
I'm sure it stuck with them. I'm sure it did.
I hope so.
Wow. Yeah, starting off an email with bruh is intense.
And I mean, I do blur their names out, but I have used that in classes. I'm like, look, don't do this. Please, for the love of God or whatever deity you pray to, do not do this, because it's
trying to help you. Don't do this.
I want you to succeed in life. I don't want you to screw up to the point where the only job you can get requires you to wear a name tag. Please, dear God, listen to what I'm telling you.
When students come to your class, like, what are they striving to be? Like, why would they take comms courses? I'm wondering what most of the students are looking to
okay,
do for
so,
a career.
So the various stuff that I've taught usually prepares them to do, well, things like this, podcasting or radio, other things like television broadcasting, or by and large, like a journalist.
That's cool.
Because writing scripts is important. Being able to write content is insanely important. I mean, I'm pretty sure you have your written out plans and itineraries and all sorts of things that you have, you know, that you prepare when you plan for doing a podcast. And so that's the big thing that I do. On occasion, I do teach public speaking courses, because that's the fundamental thing. That's the foundational thing in communication, is you have your public speaking classes, because most institutions still require that in their general education. I do enjoy that class, because I need students to understand that when you open your mouth, wherever you are representing, you know, your, not just yourself, but where you're from, where you've been, and what you intend to do in life. So please understand that, you know, you need to think just a smidge before you actually speak. So yeah. When I was still earning my PhD, I had to teach some lower level. I had to teach public speaking, and I had hockey players, and I had ROTC in my classes. And first day of class, when you're introducing syllabus and all that, I would say in the class, I'm not going to lie right now, but I'm going to let those of you who are athletes, primarily our hockey players, because the hockey program is really good, and our ROTC, I rate you a little bit harder. It's not because I'm playing favorites. But it's because the athletes, you have the potential, and some of them, because I had students just disappear because their NHL contract was bought and they just disappeared. You're going to be on a huge platform where you can speak, and heaven help you if you are asked a question in an interview and you can't get through it, because that reflects poorly on me. And so I don't want that. So
I like that. I definitely see your point. That's really good of you.
Yeah. It's like
to catch that.
It's like, I need you to give, and I get it. Sometimes you're caught in the moment. You're excited. You might have a Richard Sherman moment, and you know what? If you can pull a Richard Sherman moment, awesome sauce, but most of you can't. So
what happened with Richard Sherman? I'm unaware.
So if you remember Richard Sherman, this was years ago.
Yeah, I know who he is.
He right after the Seahawks won the game, he had defended a pass against Michael Crabtree, and he just smack-talked Crabtree the moment the interviewer came over and talked to him. He's like, you give me a sorry-ass receiver like Crabtree, that's what you're going to get. And it's like, hey, he's feisty. He's in the moment. I can excuse that.
Yeah.
But most of them kind of stammer through, and it just, you know, like you can't even make your point. No, Sherman was making a point. I'm one of the best defenders in the league. Yeah. I just proved it. If you don't like it, there's the door.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm cool with that. But most will just kind of stammer through. And that's also the point that I get on my ROTC kids, because, you know, they're going to go, once they graduate, they get their commission, they become a second lieutenant somewhere, right? Now, here's a key little fun fact. I didn't pay for college because I joined the United States Army. And so that paid, this is back before the 9/11 bill, so I only got Montgomery. That paid for my undergrad. And so, in my 4 years that I, defended Uncle Sam, I had, and this is back before, this is back when the United States Army was really struggling to meet quotas.
He says, thank you, by the way, Uncle Sam.
Yeah, I'm sure. yeah, thanks for the money. So in the 4 years that I was, out there, I went through seven second lieutenants over my platoon.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What's that all about?
It was, I don't really know.
Right.
There was a lot of, I was a private. I didn't know squat about squat, and I was okay with that. I knew my job. That's all I cared about.
True, yeah.
I'm like, I don't know what the
politics... The less you know, the better in that
case.
Yeah,
I was like, I don't know the politics of what the officers are doing.
Exactly.
I'm cool with whatever. But I remember I had one. He was freshly minted. And I always wondered about this. Why is it that when ROTC graduate and they are given their commission, the first thing they get to do is oversee a group of usually 20 people? Like, they are now in charge of 20 people. And a small handful...
How old is this person usually?
They're like 22, 23.
Oh, so you're very close in age.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm a little bit younger because I went straight out of high school.
Yeah.
And, you know, he also has to deal with NCOs, sergeants, sergeant first classes, and that, who are, you know... They've been in service for well over a decade, and even have to call him sir. And it's
really
like, yes. Oh no, that's regulation. That's what you do.
Wow.
You know. These people are, you know, they've been around. They're battle tested, and they still have to, you know, treat him with the respect that he's due. Okay. Cool. But one thing that I had a problem with was, I think the degree that you graduate with should reflect on whatever platoon or, you know, military section you're going to be in charge of. I was signal. So all the telecommunication stuff that, you do, then I've discovered lately that my job is gone. I am very obsolete, and I'm fine with that. But back then, you know, I could run an entire telephone network. I could make sure you could call. Well, back then it was basically our role was to make sure the generals could call home to their mistresses.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. But you know, you could make phone calls, you could send emails, video teleconferencing, which is brand new back then. And it was all encrypted. So no one could really tap into it unless they had the encryption keys. So, you know, that was my job. Okay. But you, sir, have a degree in culinary arts.
Oh,
How is a souffle going to help me solve this line problem that I'm currently experiencing with the satellite shot over here? Now, the satellite guys tell me this, and the other thing. Can you offer me any insight? Because
the chicken tonight's going to be paprika and garlic.
Yeah, it's like,
that's about it.
Like I can't, because I actually, one of my colleagues flipped an attitude at the guy when he, because he came in and he thought he knew things and was micromanaging, which you don't do that to privates. You just don't. Especially snarky ones from Western Pennsylvania. You just don't do that. he didn't unload on him, but he basically said, with all due respect, sir, unless you're going to bring me some French onion soup, I don't want your opinion.
Oh, sure. Right. Some warning shots being shot there, huh?
Yeah. Cause it was like middle of the night. He's stressing about, and this is during a training exercise, he's charging, why isn't the shot in? Why isn't the shot in? And it's like, why are you panicking? It's the middle of the night. No one's really using this. Like, calm down, dude.
Where's this my French onion soup?
Yeah. Like you're stressing over a training exercise. We're all supposed to be learning here. I would appreciate it if you learned to calm down. But you know. That yeah. So yeah, I used to tell the ROTC students that all the time. I'm like, look, you're gonna run into a smart aleck like me, and you better be able to command your voice enough that you can convince them that you know what you're talking about.
That's good. That's
because
good.
Because they can sniff a fraud a mile away.
That's good life advice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like that for the hockey players as well. Just like the or any sports person,
yeah,
for the media training. Because exactly what you said, man. I mean, it's bigger than you.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. And the moment you open up your mouth, you better know exactly what you're going to say. Because if you're being broadcasted, there's a lot of weight on that. And
yes.
I mean, with social media nowadays, I mean, mm-hmm. if you go viral and it's not for something positive, good luck. That shit lives forever.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So the Band of Brothers, you were in the military. I want to speak to this real quick. It's
sure.
Not, it doesn't have to do with the military, but it's just like secret societies, you know,
okay.
And frats. Are you familiar?
I'm well aware of frats. Not that I was in one, but I had to deal with students who joined frats.
So I was never in one either. Like, what's that all about? It's like, go milk a badger. It's like, go attach jumper cables to your nipples and hook it up to a car battery. It's, you know, it's like weird shit. Spend the night in Abe Lincoln's caskets.
Well,
what is that, Bill? What is that doing? Is that just like how dedicated is this person to our clique?
There's some of that. So just don't look up what an elephant walk is.
Too late.
Do that later. So there's.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's like the moment I heard that one, I was like, okay, you kids.
Yeehaw, partner.
It's like, you got to stop. Like the amount of hazing and whatnot that goes on. Like I knew at a couple of the institutions that I've been at, like when students who were like doing really well and then they decided to pledge a place, like their grades would just start slipping.
Yeah, for sure.
Their energy would just drop. Like they were usually like gung ho, ready to go and do things, but then they just couldn't even like lift a finger because they were so exhausted.
Drunk all the time, maybe.
Yeah, that may happen, but by and large, my experience with students in the classroom, was that they were just way too exhausted, because the house that they were trying to get into would do extreme things at, like, you know, at stupid o'clock in the morning. Like,
yeah, man.
What does this accomplish? But, because I would ask, because I'm genuinely curious, why would you put yourself through this stuff? And a lot of them would tell me that it was the networking possibilities. Like, you know, if you go to a place and you go in for a job and so-and-so discovers that you were part of Lambda, 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 or whatever, right, you're going to be a shoe-in. And I'm like, is that okay?
You should hire Corey. He ate dog shit out of a solo cup. Yeah, that sounds good.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. But the other thing, and I got upset at one, because I knew I had a student who was the chapter president of one, and I was talking to him about the stuff, and he's like, "Oh no, we have to vet." And I'm like, "Okay, there's a difference between vetting and then running a kid through a ringer." And then he's like, "Well, you know, we got to see how committed they are." And I'm like, "Do tell how committed they are." And one of the first things he says is, "Well, first thing you do is you put in a $2,600 non-refundable deposit." And I'm like, "I'm sorry."
And I'm out.
Like, I had always heard the joke, I don't pay to make friends, which was, you know, always a thing that I had heard about Greek houses, but I had no idea that, like, $2,600 and it's not even a guarantee.
That's some massive money, man. That's a business and a half right there.
Right. Cause they're like, "Well, the house has to function somehow." And I'm like, I get it, but that's steep. Like, does everybody pay dues? It's like, "Well, yeah, everyone pays dues every year, but like
$2,600, you guys have a movie theater in the basement and an ice rink?"
I don't know, but it was like, you're fleecing these kids who have hopes and dreams. Like, some of them, like, that I talked to, is like, "You know, my dad was this and I'm going to be that," you know, and it's like, okay, you know, like, yeah, my dad did some things too that I admired, but I also didn't want to do all the things that my dad did. Like, I didn't really want to have that nasal caterpillar he had on his face. I mean, I admired the man, but that's something I didn't want. I don't know why you feel compelled to have these colors and these Greek letters, and some of them would brand them on their bodies. And I'm like, I don't get
literal
you.
Brand or just like, oh, a yeah, tattoo?
No, they would burn it. They would burn it on their skin, their letters. And I'm like, no, I don't love anything. That
seems
much
like a Virginia thing.
No, it's nationwide. A lot of Greek houses do that. And they do it voluntarily. Wow. It's not like once you get in, it's like, okay, now you're one of us and they brand you. It's like, no, they do that voluntarily.
Oh my God, man. So take like an iron, I don't even know what it's called, and you place
just
it on
poker,
the fire,
yeah,
and then tss.
They'll do that. They'll do that.
That's dedication right there. He's on top of a $2,600
non-refundable.
Fundable.
Congratulations, you won the lottery. Now let's scar you.
Awesome. I'm in. So how was your school experience? Like your high school experience.
Oh God. Well, I'm just going to say this. The technology that's available now, I'm glad was not available when I was in high school. Primarily for my own protection. I can't imagine like kids with the cell phones that we have now when I was growing up, because I mean, I wasn't the most popular kid. Go figure. Wonder how he got so cynical. couldn't be my mother's guilt, but whatever. High school had a little bit to do with that. I learned because, at first my mother, who I love very much, although what I'm about to say does not sound like I love her.
Cover your ears.
She thought, because that if I went to public school outright, that I would become the Antichrist. My mother is a very conservative.
Technically, you did. I mean, some of your students call you the Antichrist.
Yeah, I've been called the devil. I'm cool with that. I actually wear that as a badge of honor. I've been called a lot of things, and so the devil is the least of my worries. So she thought I was going to become the Antichrist. My father was, he didn't really care, but he made a compromise with her that, you know, he can go to this Christian school, this private Christian school till the sixth grade. When he gets to seventh, he has to go to public school. He has to interact with people. And like that school, there was only like my last year there was the fourth grade because the school closed down because lack of resources. I was one of only two fourth graders, and we had the elementary was 8 kids and our teacher.
Oh, wow, dude.
Yeah. So whoa. I learned really quick how to be independent. Like our teacher would, you know, have each grade. Cause there was only, see my last year, there was a first grader, two second graders, a third grader, two fourth graders, two fifth graders.
Crazy.
Yes. And so he would have 45 minutes with each grade. And so he would, you know, whatever it is that we needed to do that day to learn, he would have our time with us. And then he would hand us basically like worksheets or whatever and says, this needs to be done by tomorrow. If you get it done, cool. The rest of the day is yours. Awesome sauce. So I learned how to be independent really quick.
What a different perspective you must have.
I think that's what put me in the position that I am in, because like I had the time to look through other things and pursue other stuff after I did whatever busy work I was given. And so, you know, I get to public school in fifth grade and instantly, I don't want to say it was overwhelmed, but I it was a bit of a culture shock for me because the classroom that I was in had 30 students.
There you go.
Yeah. And like that was the entire school body complete with faculty and administration of my last school, of the last school that I was at.
Yeah.
Cause it was a K-12. And I don't want to say I couldn't adjust, but like, I remember my guidance counselor because they had to figure out like where I was in my math and reading. So I had to go to the guidance counselor, and I'd never seen a man who looked like a walrus before.
Nice.
And I had not gone
a walrus. The way you said that was like, it could have been a walrus.
Like if you remember the original, Disney's Alice in Wonderland, the whole scene with
yes,
the walrus
exactly
and the carpenter, he kind of looked like that. And he's
like, doppelganger.
Oh. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, you're going to take these exams. The first one here is for your reading, and the next one's for your arithmetic. And I'm sitting here like, I think he's speaking words. I don't know.
Subtitles, but, please.
Yeah. I'm like, I'll do what you say. Just don't eat me. Cause I had not gone through any kind of growth spurt. I was a runt. I was like third smallest until like the eighth grade. And so like, I'm still in paranoia from him. And so I didn't really do well in the entrance exam for where I'm supposed to, my placement. And so I'm sort of stuck in what I'm doing. So I'm bored a lot. So like I had time to do whatever until the teachers finally realized he shouldn't be in this level. We're going to advise he gets pushed up because he hasn't missed a question the entire semester. And the school system said no.
Really?
Yeah. They said the state of Pennsylvania, especially with reading, math, they moved me wherever. But reading, they said I was locked. And I was locked in my reading level until eighth grade, because in eighth grade you're supposed to, in Pennsylvania back then, you were supposed to take you could start taking a language in eighth grade, but because I had done so poorly, I couldn't start taking my language until ninth grade.
Oh man.
And so like I didn't really care, it was fine, but it was just like this kind of sucks. Because but even my teacher then, she was like, I don't know why you're here. So
at that age, were you starting to see some flaws with the public school systems?
Yeah, like, I mean, I knew things, I didn't have a complete picture, but, like, I knew certain things were kind of jacked up. Like, at least, and it was, thankfully, it was a substitute teacher who saw this, because the teacher I was supposed to have had a horrific accident before the school started, and so she couldn't be in class. So we got this basically a permanent substitute, and she's like, "Why are you no? You and there's like four or five of us." She's like, "You four or five, you're going to be over here, and you're going to take this level, and you just turn it into me once a week." And that was it. I'm like, "All right, cool." She would work with the rest of the students. Like, and so we'd just be off to the side here doing our thing. And it was just like, "All right, cool, whatever."
And that meant a lot to you that she did that?
Oh, yeah. Cause I'm like, "Oh,
you remember
God.
It to this day." Yeah. That's so important. Cause if kids don't get like the necessary, you know, education that they deserve to have, that's appropriate for them, they get bored. And then it's just like, you're just wasting their time and their potential.
Yeah. Like, and that's the other thing about that stuff. Cause it's not like this stuff's, like, education is not universal for everybody. Like, I have a friend, school bored him to tears, but by golly, you give him electronics and he could tear it apart, rebuild it, repurpose it. Like, it was crazy what he could do.
Exactly.
Cause I inherited his pinball table. And he had he had souped it up. And it like made it so that you never had to pay a quarter for it at all. So all you had to do was push a button and it was like, "Hey, here's all the credits you need." And he had all like the replacement parts and like complete diagrams of like, "All right, if I need to do this, this is what you need to do." And like all, I was like, "Oh, thanks, Steve. This is great." So like even a complete idiot like me could figure this stuff out. But like, that's what he did. And, you know, like he was so bored in school, like he got in a lot of trouble. Because, you know, it's like, I have no interest in these things, and you can't tell me because I'm dumb at math, because I dance circles around the math teacher. Like, that's kind of where he was. Right. And so, like, when I had experiences like that, it's like, all right, then there has to be something going on here, where, you know, teachers are either just too set in their ways or just too lazy to change, or, you know, very few would actually engage. They would just put, you know, they would not interact as much. So it was like, I always kind of wonder why some of you care and some of you kind of look haggard on Monday morning.
Yeah, right.
Hmm.
I want to play this clip. This brings me, I have it ready to go. It's okay. This kid in he's in a school, and I'm looking at it. And if you guys want to follow along at home, if you're listening, Jeff Bliss, a student from Duncanville, owns a teacher. I don't care to hear that. But what he said, because the teacher is clearly being lazy and not teaching, and this kid really has some stuff to say that was on his mind. He makes some sense, but you probably seen this. Maybe you haven't. I'm going to play it.
No, I probably wish I did.
Okay. It's just going to be the audio.
Okay, that's fine.
Just get up and teach them instead of handing them a freaking packet, yo. There's kids in here who don't learn like that. They need to learn face to face. You're just getting mad because I'm pointing out the obvious.
No,
and you're too late.
You're wasting my time.
No, I'm not wasting your time. I'm telling you what you need to do.
Get out.
You want kids to come into your class? You want them to get excited for this? You got to come in here. You got to make them excited. You want a kid to change and start doing better? You got to touch his freaking heart. Can't expect a kid to change if all you do is just tell him.
Bye.
You gotta take this job serious. This is the future of this nation. And when you come in here, like you did last time, and make a statement about, "Oh, this is my paycheck." Indeed it is. But this is my country's future and my education.
Can you go outside, please?
But there's a limit. When I'm not bitching, but simply making an observation.
Okay.
And now I will leave. You're welcome. And if you would like, I'll teach you a little more so you can actually learn how to teach a freaking class.
Did you hear that?
Yes, I did.
All right. So what are your thoughts on that, on hearing that? Yeah. Pretty good, right?
Yes. So that touches on something that I've experienced in my time as a professor. He is not, this individual is not experiencing something that is uncommon. It is oh so common. And it's something that I stress a lot for my own classes. It was something that I kind of made a commitment to myself. Even before I even knew I was going to go after my PhD, I had a professor in my undergrad. His nickname was Dr. Ether. The man probably earned his PhD in the same class as Moses. He had been around for a while, and he was basically taking the state's money. He just didn't want to retire. He was just there. And the class that I had him for was something called Junior Seminar. Junior Seminar was basically a class on how to build a resume. Thankfully, it was only one day a week, because I could not imagine doing it more than one day a week. Because the man would come into class, and I'll never forget it, especially the day that he decided to try humor. He was talking about wrapping up. It was near the end of the semester, and he was wrapping up things, and he's like, "All right, so now, once you have your reference,"
the crypt keeper.
Like he held this stuff out like it was bad. Like everything, just so many pauses. Like Shatner today, like, bows to this man and how much he pauses. He's like, "Once you have your references, you can declare it Miller time."
Was he trying to be dramatic?
No, it's how he talked. Because he was, I don't know if he was paid. Like, I know he has a salary, but I wondered if he was getting paid by the minute. Because it was like, what are you doing? This is...
I could just stretch out these words.
Yeah, it was just a little everything more. Was super enunciated and just long. And it's like, I'm a pretty good student. I'm here. I will deal with whatever shenanigans, but I swear to the good Lord, if I'm ever in a position where students got to listen to me, I'm not going to be this boring. Thankfully, that class was on the first floor because I was looking for the window.
Well, see, here's the positive about that, that guy was so boring that you told yourself you will never be like that. So it's like you can find the positives in some negatives, which is a good trait to have.
Yeah. And so I've used that since then. Like when I've, because here's another dirty little secret about
speaking in crossword puzzles.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Here's another dirty little secret that most people don't know. College professors, we don't get any kind of what is called a pedagogy meeting or class. We are not taught how to properly teach. We are just sort of thrown the classes. Yeah. Now, you may have a basic course director that tries to help you along, but by and large, you do not have any formal education of any kind to teach you how to teach, which is funny considering that, you know, elementary and secondary education, they have to do all of that all the time because they're dealing with children. But because we are dealing with adults, it's not really viewed as that important. Like, adults should be attentive. You shouldn't have to worry about these things. But the problem is, most people who have a PhD don't really take care of the teaching part. A lot of them, because it depends on where you are, whether you're at a research institution, like your bigger schools, or you're at what we call a SLAC, which is a small liberal arts college, your demands on teaching will vary. And so oftentimes what you have is people who are very smart, who know their area of focus very well, but cannot talk or present information to kids who don't care what their research is. We don't care that you're doing research on Southwest Asian artists who lived in San Diego and Orange counties in the 1970s and the revolutionary work that they were doing. We need you to teach us this thing.
Was I right? Specific?
Yeah, but that's the thing about PhDs. You can be a deep dive into a very specific granular thing, right. And you know it can be great for you, as long as you can show it's a benefit to the contribution of human knowledge. Hot damn, we love it.
Yeah,
but the problem is, a lot of them get too tied into that, and so they don't know how to engage a student. I don't know if you've ever watched the show House.
I've seen a few episodes. I know what it is.
Okay,
yeah.
So Gregory House was always obsessed with the puzzle. Going in and doing his clinical work, like dealing with the everyday problems, he didn't really care about. And so he was just a snarky jerk to all of them, right? That's kind of what happens to a lot of PhDs, you know, especially in larger institutions. It's like, no, my research is what matters. I'll have my teaching assistant take care of you.
I see.
And so, you know, that impact and dealing with students kind of that muscle is not exercised. Now, for some, yeah, because the institution really relies on them to do their research because that can bring in money. Good for them. But the problem is there are way too many slacks, you know, smaller institutions where they don't really care about your research. You know, that's not what's going to get you tenure. It's can you be an effective educator? But some of them don't get that message. I have in my time, and this is where I applaud this student, right? He's getting his honest opinion out there. And one of the things that I've always felt is effective in reaching students is I will allow them to air whatever grievances that they have. I if they think that something's not fair that I'm doing or the institution's doing, I am totally cool with it. I'm like, if I can turn that somehow into a teaching moment, I'm gonna run with it because it's probably better than whatever I have. I mean, what I do is essentially bad stand-up comedy, and they can only handle those jokes for so long. As much as I'd like to think everybody likes my jokes, I know you can only handle so much snark at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I try my best. You know, if they've got some, I'm going to go with it. And I've told students. I remember I had one student who was complaining about how his dorm there's never any hot water. And I'm like, there are ways to get that known. And he's like, well, I've tried emailing and all this. I said, no. You got to be a little bit creative with it. Number one, you can't just be you. You got to have a group because the power of numbers, especially in smaller institutions where the impetus is getting butts in seats, they pay closer attention to this. And so I gave him an example. I have a colleague. She went to a very small institute, college, and they still separated men and women's dorms. And one of the ladies' dorms, the same thing happened with them. The water heater just broke and they couldn't get hot water. So the ladies organized themselves, and at 7 o'clock in the morning, all of them walked over to the president's house, wearing their bath towels or bath robes. And, you know, they had their shower shoes and all their beauty products, knocked on the door and said, hey, do you got hot water in your house? Because we don't have any in our dorm.
Creativity check.
Yes. It was an act of protest, nonviolent, and it communicated an idea. We need our stuff fixed. We've been complaining about this. That afternoon, it was all fixed. Never had a problem again.
Beautiful. Yeah. And so being an effective communicator is so important.
Yes.
It's so important.
And so I try to stress to them a lot. It's like, you need to understand the power that you have. And I'm not telling you to like become anarchists or anything like that. But if you see something here that you feel could greatly benefit not only you, but the rest of the student body, if you organize yourself just enough, it doesn't have to be a massive group, but just one singular voice with the same message, the school will listen to you because they're afraid of losing out on you and other students because you all carry smart bricks and you film everything you do. So, you know, oh, we can't let this get out and tarnish the reputation of our school. They're going to listen. True. So I don't want, like I say, I don't want to tell them that I'm preaching anarchy or something like that, but I'm like, I advocate, I understand. Yeah. Okay. This person doesn't teach the way you like. I'm sorry, but you can, there are things that you can do. And so like, I try to tell them all the time, you know, I don't want to be that person. So if you think I'm doing something wrong or, you know, I want that open dialogue. And a lot of my students have thanked me for that. Cause it's like, I've never had a professor who talked to me like I'm a human being. And it's like, I am discouraged that I'm hearing that right now.
Yeah. I think if we can get more teachers like that and more mm-hmm. bosses in the workplace that just have like this open door policy, they're open-minded, they're willing to have a sit down conversation. Everything's not black and white. I mean, there's a lot of gray matter, and it's just being able to speak about these things in a effective manner, you know, an articulate manner. Yeah. You know, I think it'll help us move forward.
That's a big thing I worry about, is just everybody is concerned in their own little worlds, but don't really understand that they have a community. They have the power to not only communicate with other people, but build a community about a concern that they could do something and change something. And I just try to stress to them all the time. Like I paraphrase this thing in Thor about their smart brick and Thor's hammer. You know, a hammer has the ability to build and destroy. What are you doing with your smart brick? Are you building something or are you destroying? Because from what I see from a lot of you, you're laughing at, you know, silly cat memes. So I kind of think you're destroying. I don't really think you're building anything.
It's a good analogy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what do you say, Brian? Let's wrap this up, man. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Hey, Dr. no problem.
Professor Latimer.
I'm just a dude. And the dude abides.
That was a great conversation, man. You're you have a wonderful perspective, and it makes sense now seeing what you came from, what you've been through. So I appreciate you sharing your story, and I want to give you a few seconds just to how can people reach you if they want to reach you? If I know you have a book on Amazon, how can they find you there?
Sure. So first of all, if you want to, you know, tag along with me in anything, my Instagram handle is angryphdbsl. Basically, all that is me just shit posting about how things are going in the academy. So I'm always cracking jokes. I mean, some of them you might not get, but it's totally fine. It's relatable. I also links to my Facebook as well, which is Angry PhD. The book that you mentioned, yes, this is available on Kindle now. It should be available in paperback by the end of the week. Tomorrow, I think. It's called Remus College. It is basically a book of experiences that I've seen and talked about with other PhDs and some of their wacky experiences. And I'm kind of building it. This is actually the first book out of four, because there's a lot of madness. So basically, like, this is a lot about what's going on in academia, first of all, with, you know, just how students are handled. Because I see, again, we are essentially now paying for experience, not actually learning things, but also toxic work cultures, you know, kind of like that idea, no one would believe this story if it was written. That's what I did. And so I have, like, there's stuff in here. It's like, there's no way something like this happened. But from the experiences that I've talked to with other people, these things have happened, like professors having fist fights in parking lots, students having human remains in their dorm rooms, like all sorts of insanity. And it's like, I got enough material. Like, it's four books. That's just basically what it boils down to. And it's just basically how, you know, faculty are the way that they are and the struggles they have with administration, the cultures that institutions build, you know, and sometimes kill themselves with. Yeah, it's a lot of different stuff.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack. And like I say, it sounds like all the stuff that you read in this sounds like there's no way this ever happened. It kind of has. From, like I said, this is a lot of stuff that I've had conversations with people. It's just like, no, your institution didn't do that, right? And I was like, no, they did. And it's like, holy Jesus, really? Okay.
I'm gonna have to go.
So I make it like it's all happening at one place.
Yeah.
So it's, it just seems like, how on earth is this place still operating and students still show up? And like, why hasn't some place that accredits, that, you know, gives them accreditation, hasn't shut them down? Because this is insane.
Yeah, if that doesn't make you want to go check like out that. The books, I mean,
yeah, that's on Amazon. It's Remus College. You just have to look up Brian Latimer or Brian S. Latimer, and it should pop up.
Cool. All right, man. Everyone, go check out Professor Brian. He just gave me. I'll attach the links to the bottom of this this podcast as well in the description.
So awesome sauce.
Easy. Yeah. Thanks again for being here, man.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Everyone listening, stay out of the principal's office. Be good to your teachers. Go learn something. What Brian said, you can either build something with that brick or you can destroy something. Make the right move. All right. We're out of here. Peace, everyone.
Welcome to the Curiosity Chamber.